your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Before we start, I want to thank all the Breach fans who've taken the time to review our show on iTunes. It makes all the difference. If you'd like to help extend the reach of the Breach, please leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe today. My guest today is journalist and critic Jeet Heer, a senior editor at the New Republic magazine. He's been billed as one of Canada's leading public intellectuals by the Globe and Mail, Canada's newspaper of record. Jeet was one of the first people to recognize the philosophical implications of Donald J. Trump's unconventional relationship with facts and truth. Jeet argued that Trump's not a liar, but rather a bullshitter in the sense identified by Princeton philosopher Harry G. Frankfurt in his classic essay, On Bullshit. A liar, according to Frankfurt, cares a lot about the truth because he's committed to leading you in the opposite direction. After all, a liar wouldn't be a liar if he didn't think he knew the truth. Whereas a bullshitter is indifferent. Jeet, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
You've written that, contrary to popular belief, Donald Trump is not a liar, but something else entirely. What is he?
Well, I argue that he's a bullshitter, which is, I think, a distinction distinct from being a liar. And I should say that this distinction is not something I came up with, but was argued for by the philosopher Harry Frankfurt a few years ago in his book On Bullshit, which is really like an essay that was published in the form of a book. And it made an argument that I think is very applicable to Trump, which is that a liar is someone who tells an untruth knowing that it's an untruth, whereas a bullshitter is someone who doesn't care about the distinction between truth and untruth. And therefore, Frankfurt argues, is a more dangerous figure.
What does it mean to not care about the difference between truth and untruth? Doesn't everybody who talks and asserts things in some sense care about truth?
No. Truth is, it really varies a lot in life, depending on what your goal is. Like, if you're doing sort of scientific research or scholarly research, it matters a great deal. If you're in a relationship with someone and you value that relationship, it matters a great deal. But in there are other circumstances where, you know, truth is not of high utility. And I think if you're, say, a quack salesman and you're selling a product that is, like, of dubious value, then it doesn't actually help you to know whether it works or not. It's more helpful if you don't actually care whether it works or not. You can believe in the product more.
Would it be fair to say that bullshit artists talk instead of aiming at truth to kind of present themselves in a certain light?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's the goal. It's to move the discussion away from, you know, is what is being said true or not, to is the figure presenting it compelling, and is he, you know, and then Trump always says, "Believe me, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm going to build a wall, make the Mexicans pay for it. Believe me." So the believe me is a very important thing. The goal is to gain, you know, credence, to win over the rubes, to get a gullible audience. And I think in a lot of the things that Trump says, it's a mistake to try to find out what he actually thinks, because what he thinks varies from situation to situation, right? Like, he'll say what he believes is useful for him in a particular situation. So if he's addressing a crowd of dispossessed factory workers in Ohio, he'll say China's a currency manipulator, and he's going to call it that, and he's going to change policy. And then when he's talking to the president of China and finds out he needs China's help to contain North Korea, then he'll say, "Well, I just discovered that China's not a currency manipulator." And now the second statement happens to be true, but it's not the case that he came to the truth. He just came to find out that this new line is more convenient for him right now.
And it's kind of amazing, because then there was that third stage in which he went to the AP reporter and said, "Well, he kind of is a currency manipulator, but I can't say that because I need his help on North Korea."
That's right. Yeah, which is basically, yes, exactly. And so, which I think is sort of preparing the groundwork for, like, if he ever wants to return to the position, like, you know, if he's running for re-election, he can go back to that, right? Like, so I think that there's always a kind of escape route and that there is no fixed belief. And I think that's very kind of important. And it partially explains his appeal, but also like why it's so troubling a figure. Like, I think a lot of people who supported him, like, it's not like they were totally fooled by this. They could see that he's kind of a salesman who's making a pitch, but they thought that that meant that he's very pragmatic and that he will, like, you know, he's not bringing ideological priors to issues, so he'll negotiate when necessary. But he's not so much pragmatism as opportunism. And actually, I think that for a political figure, actually not having principles is actually a liability, because you kind of have to, if you believe in certain things on a certain level, then, you know, your behavior is more predictable, and also people can rely on you, and there's also some things that you won't do. It gives you a sort of strength in negotiations. Like, I think actually for Trump, one problem he's running into is people kind of know that he doesn't believe in a lot of things, so they feel like they can push him around and get him to their point of view.
He's done that so many times where he says things like, oh, NATO's obsolete, and then the NATO ambassador comes, and 10 minutes later he's convinced that NATO's the best thing ever.
That's right. Yeah. No, it's become a recurring feature of the presidency. So, and I think that, like, I mean, there is something, I can understand the appeal of wanting a more pragmatic leader. And I think it's interesting that it showed something in the Republican voters as well, that maybe they felt like some of their own leaders were too hardcore on issues, and that Trump was a way for the party to return to a type of pragmatism. But again, I think just as there's a distinction between lying and bullshitting, there's a distinction between pragmatism and opportunism.
And it introduces an incredible amount of chaos, because it seems like what Trump believes is whatever the last person he talked to was.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think that that level of chaos is exactly what we're seeing. And it's very, it could pose like all sorts of problems. I think the easiest way to see it is in kind of like foreign policy, where there's been like a couple of cases where he's, been at variance with the sort of Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense. And so it makes it very hard for other nations to know where the United States stands. I think almost a classic bullshitting thing is to, like, you know, saying those aircraft carriers are on their way to Korea when they weren't. And I think it's a very dangerous thing for a nation like the United States to be making threats that it's not actually, it's demonstrably not backing up.
It's kind of unclear at what point they actually figured out that, I mean, the administration itself, because there was all that kind of back and forth where the Defense Department seemed to think one thing and the Oval Office seemed to think another. And I was sort of wondering where the bullshit came in, whether they just lost track of that aircraft carrier and then had to pretend like they knew where it was all along.
Yeah, well, I think, there's not a lot of clarity as to what they knew or didn't know. But I think it goes back to the original point, which is that in some ways they don't care. Like, they feel like they can impose their kind of will on reality, right? Like, that they can, you know, by saying that they're doing something, that in itself counts. And so they run into a lot of problems when people call them out on that.
Yes. I mean, imagine what would have happened if North Korea had taken them seriously and reacted as if this was a provocative gesture. And then the aircraft carrier that we were relying on to actually defend in the area was thousands of miles away. It would have been a total disaster.
That's right. Yeah. No, exactly. But I think one little bit reassuring thing that's kind of coming out is it seems like a lot of nations aren't taking him seriously. Which is going to pose all sorts of problems for the United States in the future. But it does seem like there's a kind of international consensus emerging that this guy is a paper tiger, and, you know, his bark is worse than his bite. But you never know, right? Like,
yeah,
it could be that's exactly the situation, which could also situation that would provoke a country to overstep the bounds, and then Trump, or more likely his military advisors, feel like they have to react, right? So
yeah,
it really introduces a level of uncertainty. And I feel like not enough people are thinking about this or, like, worried about the degree, like, the problem that this is going to pose and how dangerous this is.
Just recently, Trump started out saying that he was going to leave NAFTA by executive order. And by the end of the workday, he'd gotten on the phone with the prime minister and president from Canada and Mexico and had decided that he was going to announce that he's going to make NAFTA stronger.
That's right. Yeah, no, all was in one day, like less than a work day, like less than 12 hours.
But he set the peso into a tailspin, which is going to be really bad for real people.
Yeah, you don't know. That's right. Yeah. Although, again, I feel like at some point there's got to be some sort of inoculation that comes in, right? Because, I mean, initially when like he was making threatening comments to various companies on his Twitter account, like their stocks would go down. But what happened after a while was that there'd only be that brief dip and then it would recover because people figured out that what he's saying isn't necessarily what he's going to back up. And that's just like the whim of a moment, right?
This is the first presidency where Twitter has been a huge part of the president's moment-to-moment outreach. Do you feel like that medium contributes even more to the sense of unreality surrounding him?
I think so, yeah. I think that the Twitter and even more the sort of reality show television of the Sean Spicer briefings and Trump's own press interactions and it seems like maybe one way to think about this is that Trump is really the first post-Gutenberg president, the first president that's sort of really not a reader and not. And so, I mean, like, there's these sort of theorists, like, you know, famously Marshall McLuhan, but also Neil Postman and Father Walter Ong, who, like, theorized about the impact of print culture on thinking, right? That the sort of Gutenberg era created a type of culture, a mass culture of, you know, people reading a lot and getting the habits of thought that come from print, which includes sort of, like, patience, but also linear thinking, sort of a consistency of type. And Trump really is, it's not so much that he uses Twitter and he watches all the cable news, but that he doesn't read. So he doesn't have, you know, the reading to counteract that. And so he has all the sort of mental habits of the sort of, you know, social media world and of the TV world, which is that, like, everything is instantaneous. Everything is now, right?
Like, and everything is cut off from sources of evidence and justification. That's all about personal authority and the rant or the quip rather than the long-form argument or the well-documented position.
That's right. Yeah. And then also that, like, moment-to-moment consistency doesn't matter, right? That, like, you know, in some ways, what the theorists, like, you know, McLuhan and Ong argued is that it's a return to a kind of oral culture, but, you know, a technological oral culture. And that in an oral culture, it's like everything is always like a momentary victory, right? Because you're face to face and one person says one thing and the other person says another. And so for Trump, like every political interaction and every interaction is that. Like, can he, you know, he'll like say, you know, Rosie O'Donnell's a pig, and then later, like, you know, nobody respects women more than I am. And
yeah,
like whatever, like, wins that moment.
But I feel like actual cultures that trade on the oral tradition can't afford to be so hapless about what happened, that they have elaborate mechanisms of oral history and art and, you know, witnessing traditions like potlatches to conserve a very close consensus of what happened.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Yeah. He's the kind of like the oral warrior cut off from any any sort of like culture that can preserve him. But he has that trait of, you know, like if you look back on you know, the classic epics, like in Homer or Beowulf, the epic hero is like always a sort of figure that's like very well equipped with sort of insults and can, like, you know, yeah. I think like Trump really, and then the way he kind of like always creating nicknames for foes, like, you know, Crooked Hillary and Lying Ted. And then really the world, I mean, where we're closer to home, are professional wrestling.
Yeah.
So, which is, again, I mean, I think Trump's relationship to a normal presidency is the same as professional wrestling's relationship to a normal sport, right? Professional wrestling is a sort of simulation of a sport. It has, like, you know, like, it looks like it. It has the competition, the prizes, and requires real athletic ability. But then it also has a huge element of, you know, fiction and scripting. And I think that Trump is trying to have a presidency of that order.
What do you think this kind of pervasive unreality bodes for the Trump administration's relationship with Canada? Because Canada seems like, you know, I grew up there. It's a very evidence-based kind of political discourse relative to a lot of other countries.
Yeah, I think that that's a very interesting question. I mean, I think, well, it's very unpopular here. I think there was an attempt to have sort of, there has been like sort of Canadian politicians who are trying to follow in Trump's footsteps, and so far they haven't been very successful. The Conservative Party here is having their own primaries for it to select a leader. And one of the ones who most closely imitated Trump has just dropped out. I think that like Canada is a little bit lucky in being a little bit more old-fashioned that we have. For example, I mean, yeah, we don't have a Fox News. You know, like that's a kind of huge infrastructure. There was an attempt to create a Fox News in the form of Sun TV, which failed. And then also the existence of something like CBC, which is still like, you know, like one of the major media outlets and which still has a kind of like public broadcasting commitment to truth, like kind of makes a Trump figure a bit harder. Although, I mean, who knows? I think it's just maybe a matter of time. But I think that what is more generally happening is that Trump is constantly coming into conflict with people in other nations and with the political culture of other nations, just because I don't think that reality show aspect that his fan base finds attractive is attractive to people in other cultures, including people who are actually quite conservative, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think I sort of conservative people in Canada or in France or in England would, you know, like find Trump like kind of like a very jarring and shocking figure.
The stuff that's leaked about Angela Merkel's reaction to him has been pretty damning and very much in line with what you said.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, but I mean, I also think that in some ways America is just at the cutting edge of this stuff, the cutting edge of mediaized culture, and so if we try to see Trump as being, you know, partially a product of that, then it's not too difficult to imagine, you know, 10, 15 years down the line that these other countries would also, I mean, in some ways, some of them have already created their own Trump figures, like Berlusconi or Rob Ford in Toronto.
I mean, so Vladimir Putin is very much a creature of illusion who does a lot of sort of pro-wrestling type tropes in his own self-presentation in Russia.
That's right. Yeah. So in some ways, I think that is not... So yeah, we shouldn't make like such an absolute distinction between the United States and other countries. Like, I think that, you know, the forces that produce Trump exist in many different societies. I think that what Trump might pose for other countries is a question of how do they resist, you know, their own kind of demagogues and what are the sort of institutional barriers. And I think maybe, I mean, one thing you're seeing is like a sort of reaction to the fake news in places like France and Germany, where there's a real kind of effort to see if, you know, if that was part of the problem, then to try to like clamp down or challenge, you know, outlets that are, you know, presenting outright lies and bizarre conspiracy theories.
Do you think that there's a connection between the rise of these emotive, fact-impoverished communication styles and the rise of authoritarianism itself?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I mean, I think that the authoritarianism is a kind of like the natural politics that goes along with it, because in some ways, it's not just a matter of like being averse to facts, but also being averse to a style of politics that is traditionally democratic, which involves sort of, you know, conciliation, compromise, discourse, debate,
justification,
right?
Evidence, process.
Yeah, exactly. There's a whole array. The sort of the populist demagogue, you know, presents himself or herself as the sort of the antithesis of that, because the idea is that that system is corrupt and inadequate and bad, and that the voice of the leader is the voice of the people and is precisely the voice and precisely the qualities that are off-putting. You know, crudeness, the simplification, aggressiveness, unwillingness to compromise, these are marks of authenticity, that they're marks that this person is the voice of the people. And it can transcend the sort of, you know, what are seen as the faults of traditional democratic politics.
Is that a cyclical thing, where a more emotive style tends to alternate with a more deliberative style in different eras?
I don't know. I mean, I'm generally skeptical of sort of cyclical views of history, because I think, you know, I mean, I feel like it's...
Or maybe more like fads and fashions, like skirt lengths or tie widths, where you have, you know, different swings towards one pole or the other, not necessarily that it's a cycle like sunspots.
Yeah, sure, sure. But I mean, I think that there is maybe an element of fetishes, but if there is something, I think it's more deeply rooted in political economy and in sort of technology, right? Like, I do think that once you have new technologies, they can allow voices that are not otherwise heard to make themselves heard and can sort of, you know, short circuit the traditional norms. And also, the sort of economic situations of like sort of rising inequality and sort of stagnant economies also make these same voices very appealing. So I wouldn't necessarily say cyclical feels, a little bit like this happens by itself. Whereas I do think that it's very much connected to things that we can actually identify.
Does this shift to the more emotive style of politics put the left and progressives at a systematic disadvantage?
I'm not sure that it quite works that way, because I think that there's there are elements of the left that can very much take advantage of this. Like, I think that the sort of emotive style cuts across the left-right divide. Like, if you have, you know, like someone like Chavez or other politicians on the left could very easily exploit the same style. Like, it might, to the extent to which, if you consider like left-wing politics to be tied to like policy and the evidence, then I think it cuts against any politics that is very heavily empirical. I think the bias is more anti-empirical than anti-left.
It's interesting. I go back and forth on this. It seems like in the current political climate where, you know, leftist progressive politics is pretty centrist and still very evidence-based at the professional level, that it's empowering different kinds of cultural critics. That part of the reason I think comedians are coming to the fore and entertainers is because they're able to compete on this not strictly rational level.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Yeah, and that, in some ways, you kind of need a left politics that can do that. And I don't necessarily think even like the whole idea of an appeal to emotions is necessarily like a bad thing. Like, I think that there really is no such thing as like a good policy that's just good on, you know, like a factual basis that like anyone can agree with. Like,
sure.
All policies have to have like, you know,
some kind of Humean pull to make people attracted to them or repelled by them.
And they have to have, I would imagine that certainly the politicians on the left that have been successful, I mean, you can almost like it's almost blindingly clear, right? Like, the last two Democratic presidents have been like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, who certainly have an emotional appeal, and then they've lost with Dukakis, Al Gore, John Kerry, and Hillary Clinton, which, you know, are not the four most charismatic figures in political life.
Justin Trudeau has also done really well introducing, you know, an emotion in the sense of him being in touch with his feelings in Canadian politics.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think that that is a big part of the appeal. And again, you can sort of draw the contrast between Justin Trudeau and, you know, because they had like several Canadian politicians that led the Liberal Party before Trudeau had failed, you know, like Michael Ignatieff, Stéphane Dion, Paul Martin, all of whom were like more kind of cerebral, intellectual, and sort of a bit harder for the general public to relate to. So whereas Trudeau, you know, offering really the same policy prescriptions as his Liberal predecessors, like, you know, just conveys a greater sense of caring, you know, of concern, and that these issues are sort of visceral for him, like he feels them, and rather than just thinks them.
Trump's attacks on the news media, can those be seen as an attack on the idea of intersubjectively verifiable truth itself?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of what he is trying to do with the attacks on the media. Like, I do think that the idea is that it's just any criticism of Trump is coming from a place of dishonesty, and to polarize a sense of who you can trust and who you can't trust. And I imagine that it sort of shielded him from a lot of criticism. Like, I think if a large swath of the Republican Party had trusted the mainstream media, they would have like looked at the stuff about Trump and decided this guy can't be president. But like, they've had almost like 40 years of training to think that the, you know, mainstream media can't be trusted. And so Trump in some ways is just sort of continuing that, but he's continuing a longstanding attempt to break down a sort of common ground of trust in media. And in some ways, yeah, figure like, I mean, I think it helped elect him, and it's probably going to help shield him in any sort of scandal or controversy that comes up. Because, like, if he does have, like, an impeachment hearing, there'll be, like, a, you know, 30, 40% of the population that will just disbelieve any scandalous evidence about him.
It's amazing how far back his attacks on objective evidence go. Like, you see his crusade against quote-unquote fake news presaged in this war that he had in Atlantic City with this casino analyst called Marvin Roffman, who was a really respected guy in the gaming industry, who pointed out quite reasonably, and what should have been obvious to everyone, was that Atlantic City wasn't a big enough or a seasonal enough market to support all of Trump's giant casinos without them cannibalizing each other. But when he said that, Trump had him destroyed, essentially. He called up his bosses and got him fired.
Yeah, I think that the, I mean, Trump's instincts on that are quite correct, that the most dangerous thing for him is sort of evidence. And I think, like, a large part of Trump's skill set is he understands media culture, and he understands, like, how to game the system and to get press, and how to try to discredit people who go against them. I imagine that this is a lot of stuff he picked up from Roy Cohn, actually.
Yeah.
Who's just kind of a mentor. And, you know, and because a lot of it is sort of like standard McCarthyism.
You deny everything, assail the questioner.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And then to make any critique about the person criticizing you rather than you yourself. And to create a sort of hyper-polarized environment. Which becomes a question of which side are you on rather than what is the truth. So I feel like, and again, I think this all indicates, I mean, it goes back to your earlier point about, is this cyclical? I think rather than think of it as cyclical, I think that there's always been a strand of this in American politics. There's always been these kind of Trump-like figures that we can, you know, like Joseph McCarthy. I mean, Nixon to a lesser extent, but still had some of these same tendencies, you know, going back to in the 30s, Father Coughlin and Huey Long. So I feel like this is always a kind of tendency within democracy. And then we kind of have to explain, you know, why in our particular this tendency has taken over, you know, the presidency.
What do you think would happen if Trump were forced to produce his tax returns and they had incontrovertible evidence of wrongdoing?
Well, I think that he would, you know, via Alex Jones or Michael Cernovich or others, just like put out something as to why that can't be trusted. Like that, I mean,
yeah, he'll just move the conspiracy larger and larger so that any basis common evidence is lost eventually, because you can't trust the media, you can't trust the government, you can't trust science, you can't trust your friends.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would imagine it would be like that. This is Obama invented those tax returns, right? Like, you know, in Kenya, that the
if
you start from the premise like Obama was born in Kenya or whatever, like, then what else can you like not believe, right?
It's fascinating how authoritarianism and conspiratorial thinking seem to go together too.
Yeah, no, I think that the in some ways there's a kind of natural affinity, in part because the opposite is also true. Like, I think to have a democratic government, you kind of have to have a belief that, you know, basically, you know, there might be a few people doing bad stuff behind the scenes, but basically everybody's on the up and up. You can, you know, have debates with people that are good faith debates. You can appeal to a common set of evidence and have different interpretations of that. Whereas, like, sort of conspiratorialism makes that all that impossible. And so the natural solution is the authoritarian leader.
I mean, it's interesting where the authoritarianism reinforces the conspiratorial beliefs by its nature, because it sort of is evidence that everything is corrupt, that it's not fair, it's not a democracy. And so people spin conspiracies to fill the vacuum.
That's right. Yeah. All these things kind of always they reinforce each other. And Trump has very good instincts on this. I mean, like, he always knows, you know, like, what the sort of connections. I think on the Russian stuff, like, you know, there's a lot of liberals who kind of have this magic bullet faith that, you know, something will come out about Russia that will discredit Trump and he will, be impeached. But, like, you know, you can sort of already see that Trump is laying a groundwork for, like, you know, why any new evidence can't be trusted, right? Like that is, like Obama was spying on Trump. It's all coming from these Obama holdovers. There can't be any incontrovertible facts because no such facts exist in Trump's universe.
That's all the time we have for today. Jeet, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, this was fun.
Each week on The Breach, we give you a little homework to sharpen your knowledge of authoritarianism and corruption. In our very first episode, Zephyr Teachout and I focused on the Foreign Emoluments Clause of the Constitution and how Trump's business holdings might violate it by accepting payments from foreign governments. Our first recommended reading is about a possible violation of the Domestic Emoluments Clause, which prevents the president from accepting payments from the states. Julia Hart of Reuters reports that this could be a problem for Trump because state pension funds invest in his hotel. Our next item is called The Convicted Con Artist of the Winter White House by Tarini Party of BuzzFeed. A convicted fraudster who owes his victims hundreds of thousands of dollars is married to the woman known as the house mother of Mar-a-Lago, and he's milking it for all it's worth. That's all for recommended reading. The Breach is produced by Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Tweet your suggestions, comments, and questions to @Beierstein, BEYERSTEIN, on Twitter. See you next week.